The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada 2 Hewitt live at side of Studio North on July 26, heading down south to Atlanta later today. Hope you've downloaded the Salem News Channel. Biggest story has very few details from overnight. A 37-year-old woman fired several gunshots at Love Field yesterday, having entered near a ticketing counter, went into a bathroom, changed clothes, and emerged, came out shooting, apparently at the ceiling. Officers wounded her, shot her in the leg, brought her down. But we have no additional details. That was 16 hours ago, and we have no additional details. We don't know who shot her either. I assume it's Dallas police would be at the perimeter. TSA would be back further. And I don't think TSA folks are armed at that level at the front of the check-in counter, but Dallas police would be. That's just a very odd story. I was talking to Fetching and Mrs. Hewitt. We remember when not long after 9/11, an Orange County man drove from Orange County to LAX and decided to attack the airline ticket counter, which may be the dumbest thing in the world to attack because they're all, you know, like Mossad and IDF special forces. And that guy was dead in about 5 seconds, but she's not dead. She's wounded, but there are very few details. I mean, her name's in here. I'm not going to put her name out there. We would just expect more after 16 hours. Also yesterday, slow uptake of Pfizer's COVID drug hints at end to sales boom. This is from the Financial Times this morning. And the Financial Times is reviewing the fact that Paxlovid is out there and it's very, very effective. So why aren't people taking it? By effective, that means as soon as you feel bad, as soon as you get a positive COVID test at home, or you just have the symptoms, especially loss of smell, you ought to immediately begin taking this. You're supposed to take Paxlovid within 3 days of the onset of infection, and it makes it mild and it makes it free. The, you know, online, there's some basement doctors who are saying, oh, there's a rebound, you know, all the standard negative stuff about COVID. I'm just a science person. I just listen to my family toxicologist and it works. It's very effective, but they have so screwed up the guidance on it. I mean, if you're over 65, you can walk up to any pharmacist in America and say, hey, Paxlovid, I've got a positive test, and they'll give it to you. But if you're under 65, they won't. So then you need a note from your doctor. And that, of course, means you're going to be 3 days before you get that, and it's too late to take Paxlovid. So the FDA's got its hands up in the air saying, why won't people take Paxlovid? I'll tell you why, because they made the guidance so stupid again. It's the same thing they did to the J&J, the same thing they did to the vaccine rollout. They over-bureaucratize everything. John O'Sullivan has an argument today in the National Review, which I put out on my Twitter feed, at Hugh Hewitt. And all the social media accounts are at Hugh Hewitt on Twitter. I have a Facebook page for the show. I also encourage you to download Salem News Channel, follow Town Hall Review. You'll get everything I write and the Washington Post. I should have an editorial out today on Brett Stevens' column of last week. And the rage-filled 1-6 Nancy Pelosi committee's attack on Josh Hawley, and why I don't care what the left says. It was simply a demonstration, an open kimono of the real fury that drives the committee, which is irrational, the irrational anti-Trump hatred. Everybody knows January 6th was a nightmare and everyone has condemned the riot. And everyone I know wants everyone prosecuted who entered illegally and did so with the appropriate mens rea, legal term. And if they were involved in seditious conspiracy, you prosecute them for seditious conspiracy. But I do not see any cause and effect causation between the Trump speech. I don't see a grand plan. I see a lot of attempt to persuade the vice president to put votes aside, which is not a criminal argument. There is no criminal law against that. That's an interpretation, wrong interpretation of the Electoral Count Act, but it's not a crime. And so the idea that there's some kind of crime here is just simply a left-wing fantasy like the Steele dossier, just like the Steele dossier, like Russia, Russia, Russia. What is not an imagination is the Wall Street Journal story, China targeted Fed to build informant network. access data, a probe says. China tried to build a network of informants inside the Federal Reserve System, at one point threatening to imprison a Fed economist during a trip to Shanghai unless he agreed to provide non-public economic data. The investigation by Republican staff members of the Senate Committees on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs found that over a decade, Fed employees were offered contracts with Chinese talent recruitment programs, which often include cash payments, asked to provide information on the U.S. economy, interest rate changes, and policies, according to a report of findings released on Tuesday. What a surprise. The Chinese are spying on us. Now, a lot of people on the left, think that espionage ended when the Americans were canceled. They just don't have any idea the breadth and depth and scope of the Chinese Communist Party's penetration efforts. And I mean, they are vast and they are everywhere. And we are not paying attention, but maybe people will begin to realize that if you have a Chinese national and you're employed, green card holder or not, it is very likely that of the, you know, I don't know, 500,000 of them, 100,000 such green card holders or more are working for the CCP, not for because they're maligned, trained at CCP Central, but because the CCP is leaning on their family back home. So a couple of clues. If they have spent more than 3 months, or actually 1 month, in mainland China in the last year or two, consider them compromised. You don't have any evidence, but just treat it like you wouldn't give them the keys to the kingdom. And if they are going back and forth to China with regularity, you don't let them near your intellectual property. Also in the New York Times, U.S. officials grow more concerned about potential action by China on Taiwan. Yeah, they're just getting around to that, apparently. I don't buy the Pentagon isn't, but the New York Times is. Pentagon has been worried about that for quite some time. Also in the Wall Street Journal, investors bet Fed will need to cut interest rates next year to bolster the economy. Yeah, we're going to be in a recession as of Thursday when the GDP comes out. And by the way, we're going to have a clear division between left-wing legacy media and old-school legacy media, between the people who say, well, a recession started in Q1 2022, and those who say this isn't a real recession. The latter people are spinning for Biden. We're going to be in a recession. They're obviously preparing the way so that people don't freak out. It is a recession. I don't know if it's going to go three quarters or four, but it's a recession. Apparently going to be a mild one, but it's a recession. Joe Biden took us into a recession. That's what you need to know. Democrats took us into a recession. The way to get out of a recession is to cut taxes and regulation. That's how you, and public spending. That's how you get out of recession. John O'Sullivan wrote a great piece on the competition for the British prime ministership, the Tory race between Liz Truss and Rishi Sunak. In fact, here is a clip from that debate, the first debate last night on the BBC, cut number one.
Everybody understands that COVID is a 1-in-100-year event, and trying to pay it back straight away so quickly that we actually damage our economy, that we end up causing a recession, that we end up in people being out of work, and that hardworking taxpayers who do the right thing have seen their taxes rise, despite the fact that we promised in our manifesto
You just mentioned three countries. Do you know what mortgage rates are in the US at the moment? Do you want to use them as an example? Their mortgage rates are almost 50% higher than mortgage rates in this country because they're borrowing so much.
Project fear.
I remember the referendum campaign, and there were only one of us who was on the side of Remain and Project Fear, and it was you, not me.
Okay.
And you talk
maybe
about
I've
this.
Maybe I've learned from that. It was a good exchange. The moderators kept getting in the way again. The problem with every debate everywhere, unless I'm running it. Welcome back, America 2. You're joined now by Drucker, David M. Drucker of the Washington Examiner, D.C. Examiner. You can follow him online on Twitter, David M. Drucker. David, your story today is that of Republican disappointment with fundraising. And I've got a different theory than you, but why don't you present what your report, not theory, you reported different reasons why there are fewer dollars in Republican tills. I'll tell you my theory after you tell people what you discovered.
Well, I talked to a lot of Republican digital strategists and others involved in campaigns, not on the sidelines, but actively working in campaigns. I asked them why the money was low. They're on track to win, possibly in historic fashion. That should generate, it has generated a lot of voter enthusiasm. We know that from the polling. And usually when one party's on track to do well, at this point in the cycle, maybe not a year ago, but a few months out, fundraising really picks up, if it hasn't already. And what we know is that in the second quarter, April, May, and June, fundraising dipped. And we know particularly the grassroots digital fundraising that overall continues to grow for Republicans. But in the second quarter, it dipped, particularly in a lot of these key races, but also for the big party groups. And what Republicans are telling me is that, number one, inflation has taken a bite out of their particular donor population's wallet and left less money for discretionary spending like political donations. But the other thing, and Republicans have been complaining about this for quite a while, is that former President Donald Trump continues to raise a lot of money, even though his fundraising also dipped in the second quarter. And he's holding on to it, and he's holding on to it for himself. But normally, in midterm election cycles, a party doesn't have to compete with a presidential figure like a Trump, who's raising a ton of money for an election that's not this cycle, but the following cycle, you know, if he runs. And so that's what I've reported. That's what a lot of Republicans were telling me, unprompted. And, you know, it's in line with what I have seen over the, you know, past couple of years. But particularly given the slacking Democrats could be headed for, the fact that their giving hasn't ebbed at all, but has accelerated, is just an interesting factor. I can point to reasons why that are logical, but Republicans had been keeping pace to some degree, and now they're not.
I have two theories here, David. One is the presence of the billionaire donor, the Peter Thiels of the world, the Zuckerbergs and the Zuckboxes, have made small donors feel a little bit more insignificant. And they wonder, why would I give 25, 50 or 100 to Eric Schmidt in Missouri, for example? And I'll come back to why they should. But that's nevertheless, you know, why do I matter if Peter Thiel is going to give J.D. Vance $10 million? It doesn't really matter. And then the second thing is they're alert to the grift. And if you remember in the early days of email, you'd get the email from the Nigerian prince who wanted to give their money away. And a lot of people fell for that, right? They fell for various scams. Well, people have learned, you know, repetition, muscle memory, to be alert to the grift and to the phishing and to the scam artists and the grifters in politics, you know, the Lincoln Project and many other groups that parade as though they're going to put your money to work are simply fraud. And they're pocketing 70, 60, 50% of whatever they're raising as opposed to 7% overhead. And people don't want to give to that anymore. And they don't know. WinRed might turn this around. WinRed is legit. But I, what do you think of my two theories, both billionaire donors and grifters?
Well, look, Q, here's what I would say. WinRed, broadly speaking, is turning it around. And it's because Republicans got to this party so late, meaning the online donor party, but they don't have a donor pool as big as the left does from which to draw. And so when there are factors like, let's say, a Trump or inflation or anything else, it's harder for them to cushion the blow, right? I mean, Democrats have maybe, you know, 30 million donors, Republicans 7 or 8 million, depending on the donor file that we are talking about. And so Democrats started doing this around 2004, 5, 6. Republicans only started really doing this with WinRed, you know, 2018, 2019. So correct, that is part of it. But what I would tell you is, as important as the wealthy donor is, the wealthy donors have been, their importance in campaigns year by year has been going down. And if you talk to any strategist who talks about raising money, particularly for presidential campaigns, they will tell you if you don't get into a campaign, unless you can write an unlimited check for yourself with a healthy donor file, then you're really putting yourself at a disadvantage. And so these donors continue to move up in importance versus the donor with the big checkbook, the bundler with the big Rolodex. It's just not quite the same.
Yeah, bundlers are almost done. And bundlers have almost been, they're the velociraptors of politics. They're extinct. Let me ask very quickly. I saw the Trafalgar Group poll of Eric Schmidt ahead and Vicky Hartzler in second place, and Eric Greitens fading, thank God, because we'd lose that seat. I think Trafalgar does better than anyone else. Who do you think is going to pull that out, David Drucker? It's next week.
Well, I've seen a few polls with Greitens in third and Schmidt Hartzler at the top. So if that holds, then next Tuesday, that's how it's going to finish.
I hope it's Eric Schmidt. I really do. He can win easily. There's no sense in spending money and having to work hard for a seat that you ought to just walk away with. And Eric Schmidt would do that. That's an endorsement to the extent it matters. I'm not sure anyone in Missouri cares what you do it thinks, but I would vote for Eric Schmidt. Thank you so much, David Drucker, coming back with Byron York on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined as I am on most Tuesdays by Byron York. You can follow him at Byron York on Twitter. You can subscribe to his newsletter at dcexaminer.com. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing well. Thanks.
I want to move to Nancy Pelosi's 1-6 committee, but only after I get your assessment of the Missouri Senate race. I've been worried for months that Democrats were going to nominate, along with the help of some innocent Republicans, Eric Greitens. Now, he is collapsing, according to both Trafalgar and this morning Emerson. Looks like Eric Schmidt's going to be the nominee, and what would have been a likely loss for the Republicans becomes a surefire win if Eric Schmidt is the nominee. How confident should I feel about Schmidt, who I've endorsed being the nominee?
I think you should feel pretty confident because I think there's a factor that kicks in when an election gets closer, and that is the reality of a candidate actually winning gets closer. And I think with Greitens, that is actually hurting him. And, you know, Republicans are really kind of terrified about repeating the mistakes in the Senate of 2010, the O'Donnell, Todd Akin, and Sharon Angle mistakes, which cost the Republicans the Senate. They had to wait till 2014 to actually win the Senate. So I think, you know, it's 50-50 now. They just have to get to 51, and I think they're pretty aware of that.
All right. Now, let me turn to the 1-6 committee. Proposition number one, it was illegitimate from the first day that Nancy Pelosi attempted to control the minority party's participation. And so when Kevin McCarthy walked away, and he even accepted the first interference was the appointment of the two anti-Trump Republicans, Liz Cheney and Kissinger, the illegitimacy has never been cured. It can't be cured because it's in the original construct. However, as it went forward, there was a chance to redeem reputation of the committee, which has been flunked because they won't release the transcripts. They have no opposition. There's no adversarial process. Tom Cotton pointed this out. And yesterday, I'm pretty irate over the obvious admission against fairness of the videotape of Josh Hawley running from the mob, because that is used for no purpose other than to inflame passions and to settle opinions about to damage Hawley. It's a revenge tour. It's got nothing to do with what Trump was doing during the 187 minutes. It's got nothing to do with anything. It's just an attempt to revenge the committee upon Hawley. Cotton agreed with my assessment, said he hadn't watched the hearings, and very few people have watched most of them. And I'm not one who've watched much of them, but I did tune in after talking to Kissinger on Tuesday night to see the beginning clip of Mitch McConnell, and I knew right then it was just a show. Liz Cheney tweeted at Tom Cotton yesterday, "Hey, Tom Cotton, heard you on Hugh Hewitt criticizing the January 6th hearing. Then you said the strangest thing. You admitted you hadn't watched any of them. Here's a tip. Actually watching them before rendering judgment is more consistent with Anglo-American jurisprudence." Liz Cheney, who is a friend, is actually quite wrong about this. "I don't need to watch the Stalin show trials to know they were show trials. I don't need to watch Khmer Rouge or any other totalitarian episode or any authoritarian episode or even any corrupt American judicial system episode to know when the fix is in." Is Liz coherent here?
Isn't an adversarial process really important in Anglo-American jurisprudence?
Yes, and open. You the right to confront. This is not exactly a grand jury. This is an investigative hearing.
The secretiveness is just absolutely incredible because we have just heard snippets of the interviews that the committee has done, and they've done hundreds of them. And even though they have made portions of the testimony public, usually in videotape clips, we haven't seen any transcripts. We haven't seen any full video. We've seen, you know, there are witnesses where we've heard 12 to 15 words of what they testified and nothing else. And the other thing to remember is this is a congressional committee. It has to have, under the rules of Congress and under the rules of this committee, it has to have a legislative purpose. That's the phrase they use, a legislative purpose. Now, Liz Cheney has often said that their legislative purpose is to consider laws to go after Donald Trump, new laws that could go after some Trump of the future. But the whatever you think about that, there's absolutely no doubt that the Hawley thing served absolutely no legislative purpose, and they can't tell you one.
Why do you think, if you put the, I try to see things through the eyes, the best case, try and put myself in the position of the committee, the 1-6 Pelosi committee, and their chair and their and Liz Cheney. Did they discuss it, and what do you think they thought they were doing with the Hawley clip?
Well, they thought they were going to make a hit with a certain part of their constituency, and indeed they did. I mean, if you've seen the videos,
jogging Twitter. Josh running Hawley, it's a meme generator, but exactly. It's an attempt to shame. It's not an attempt to blame. It's just an attempt to mock and allege hypocrisy, which it isn't. It's neither hypocritical nor crazy to run from a mob. And he did not encourage the mob to enter Congress. It's just an attempt to actually indict the innocent.
Well, the thing is that Hawley took a position on January 6th. And there's that famous photo with the raised fist. And he objected to the certification of some states, the votes of some states. He was going to do more, except the whole process was interrupted by the Capitol riot. So if he pays a political price for that, that's fine. I mean, that's something he chose to do on January 6th. If his political opponents in Missouri are somehow able to capitalize on that and defeat him the next time he's up, that's fine. The point is that in this investigative committee that's serving some sort of legislative purpose, and I should have mentioned that the obvious legislative purpose when considering the events of January 6, 2021 is reforming the Electoral Count Act.
Yes.
Have you seen the January 6 committee on reforming the Electoral Count Act? No. You have not, because it's a get Trump committee. And the actual legislative purpose to come out of this, they're not saying a word about.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I have tried to be quiet on the committee because Liz Cheney is a friend. And I am second in respect for her father and mother to no one. I work for Lynn Cheney. I've had her on. I've had every member of the family on. Liz has been on many, many times. So I've just remained silent on this because I do not use my show to attack former colleagues and friends. I'm not going to start now. But when you play the Josh Hawley, the whole committee makes that choice. That's not one person. The committee makes a choice to play a snippet. And of course, the left knows now that they bared their teeth. The mask came off with that, and they ought not to have done it. And so they're doubling down and having done it. But I know they shouldn't have done it, and you know they shouldn't have done it, because it serves no purpose except to revenge angry people on Josh Hawley. And by the way, Josh Hawley is going to be senator for life in Missouri. He's not ever going to lose in Missouri. He's going to be there as long as he wants to run. He might not have a presidential future, I don't know, but he's going to be senator forever. Does anyone not understand that, Byron? Are they purposefully ignorant of what they did because they're just playing to their 1%?
Well, what they're trying to do, and there's, as you know, there is a debate going on right now about whether what they're doing is having any effect on the electorate. And some Democrats are looking and hoping that, is that it? Maybe it is having an effect. They're hoping to see that it's having some effect. And Republicans are saying, hey, nobody's paying any attention. Nobody cares about January 6th. I don't actually know. But, I mean, there are two political goals the committee is approaching, is aiming for. One is to somehow disqualify Donald Trump from being the Republican nominee in 2024. Whatever it takes, an indictment, some sort of slander, whatever it takes to do that. Now, by the way, they have shown a lot of evidence of Trump behaving in an appalling manner on January 6th. It's not news, but
it's
they
not news.
Shown it.
I've got to ask you about one last thing. The best commentator in American politics is Brett Hume, present company accepted. And Brett Baer has the only news show left in America, in my view.
Correct.
Brett says to Brett two nights ago, it has been so utterly one-sided, before saying maybe it moved the needle a little bit. But that phrase, it has been utterly one-sided. So, does anyone have any doubt about what that refers to and will forever? Have we ever seen anything this one-sided, Byron York?
Never, never, and I doubt you will again.
I agree. That is what they cannot run away from. No matter how many tweets and how many left-wing people write the opposite, and Colbert and Chris Hayes and all of them, they will never get away from the abusive process and the destruction of congressional precedent. Follow Byron at Byron York. Follow Brett and Britt, by the way. Follow the smart people in America.
This is a red alert for hardworking Americans who are tired of seeing their freedoms and savings threatened by the globalist agenda. Wealth Protection Research is on a mission to find whistleblowers who are exposing the schemes that threaten your financial security. We're talking about real, patriotic financial warriors like Jim Rickards and Porter Stansberry. They're not afraid to tell it like it is, exposing how the system is rigged against you. Text IDEAS to 76626 to find out more. With the 2024 election storming our way, your IRA and your 401k appear to be in the crosshairs. That's why we've compiled our three favorite ideas from freethinkers. Don't wait for a knock on your door telling you it's too late. Get this critical report. Text IDEAS to 76626. The fight for your financial freedom is on. Text IDEAS to 76626 now for your free report. That's IDEAS to 76626. Standard text and data rates may apply.
American politics, not the crazy people. I'll be right back, America. Stay tuned.
Somewhere beyond the sea.
Welcome back, America. That music means Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, joins us, author most recently of 2034 and a wonderful book on leadership. Admiral, good morning. It's great to talk with you again.
Thanks, Hugh. Great to hear your voice.
I want to begin with Ukraine. And Michael Waltz came back from the Kodal, went on Brett Baer last night and talked about Germany having made a lot of promises, not living up to it, and the need to get them weaponry, but to watch where the weaponry goes. Good, solid stuff. Where are we, in your view, strategically in Ukraine?
We are providing about 90% of what the Ukrainians need in order to, at a minimum, hold their position, and at the maximum, begin to achieve some gains in counterattacks. When I say 90%, there are two things I think we need to get in their hands soon and immediately would be a good target, and that would be tactical aircraft. Think A-10s, the Warthogs, that can go after Russian armor on the battlefield, and, of course, the F-16. Both of those will take some time to train these pilots, but I've seen reports that there's some training already in progress. So additional air power, and then the other systems I would like to see in the hands of the Ukrainians are more and heavier anti-ship cruise missiles to go after the Black Sea fleet. I think other than that, we have provided them the tools. We need to up the number of HIMARS, but overall, I think in a strategic sense, we're in a reasonably good place, providing them the tools that they need to respond to this invasion.
Now, Admiral, I talked to Henry Kissinger on Thursday and aired it on Friday about his new book, which you will love, by the way, Leadership. And
Hugh, yes? I wrote a review of it, a very lengthy one, in the Wall Street Journal that I like to think of as the review of record. But I commend it to your audience, many of whom I think read the Journal. It is a terrific book.
Isn't it? It's amazing he's 99. But here is the key clip from the interview. I want you to hear him talking about Ukraine. Can you play that for me, please?
Now we're in a situation in which Russia has attacked a sovereign country that wanted to be part of the Western world. So the outcome has to be one in which the Western powers are not defeated.
All right, so I want to repeat that in unaccented English. We are in a situation in which Russia has attacked a sovereign country that wanted to be part of the Western world. So the outcome has to be one in which the Western powers are not defeated. That is artfully put, Admiral. What do you think he means, and do you agree?
Well, first of all, it sounds a lot better in his Germanic English. Dr. Kissinger is just so amazing to be around. I think he chose his words very carefully, as he always does. He's the consummate diplomat and understands better than anyone how important the choice of words are. So when he says the Western powers must not be defeated, he didn't choose words such as the Western powers must achieve total victory.
Correct.
What he is saying is we have got to thread the needle. Because Russia is nuclear armed, we can't simply say, you know what, we're going to back the Ukrainians, we're going to roll NATO troops in there, we're going to eject the Russians. I think if Russia was not a nuclear armed power, I think we perhaps would have already made that strategic move. But what Dr. Kissinger wisely is counseling, in my view, is provide the Ukrainians the tools they need, get to a static place on the battlefield. We're not quite there, but we're getting closer. It would be nice to give the Ukrainians some offensive push so they could go after Kherson, for example, and threaten Crimea. Here we start to get kind of battlefield tactical. But effectively, Hugh, get this to a relatively static position and then drive both parties to a negotiation. And that negotiation, then it's up to the Ukrainians what they are willing to accept in terms of achieving peace. You and I have talked about the 1939 war in which the Soviet Union invaded Finland, the so-called Winter War. At that one, the Finns at the end chose to cede about 10% of their territory to the Soviets in order to achieve peace. They guaranteed neutrality. Maybe the Ukrainians would accede in that deal. Maybe they would not. But the point is, what Kissinger is saying is we can't allow the Russians to overrun Ukraine, nor can we afford to demand total victory and achievement of all of our objectives. This is not a rerun of World War II.
Now, I got to also tell you, Admiral, the conclusion of leadership by Dr. Kissinger it reminded me of your bookshelf book, because he emphasizes how leaders have to read. Leaders must always be reading, especially in this age of image. And then he diagnoses what's wrong with our politics, which is we are seeking images, and elected leaders are seeking the right images that go viral. They're not actually seeking understanding or rational exchange. They're seeking vibrancy in their base and response to the image. And the ubiquitous screen is sort of destroying not just literacy, but politics. I thought it was rather doom laden, as was his assessment of China-U.S. relations being sort of headed towards the 2034 conflict you imagine.
Yes, but I would add he talks about not just the need, but his view that these kind of challenges will ultimately provide for the emergence of leaders who are grounded in history, who understand diplomacy, who have moral compasses that sail true north, who understand how to manage risk in the way we were just talking about. My latest book, To Risk It All, dives in on this idea of choosing wisely when you're in the most critical situations. I came away feeling relatively hopeful about where it's going. And, you know, as I look around the landscape, I think we have leaders who can do all those things. Certainly books like Leadership by Henry Kissinger will be at the top of the list for anybody who aspires to a role in global engagement.
Yeah, Admiral, I'm not so optimistic because of the ubiquity of ignorance. I'm both right and left. I'm not being ideological here. There are some people who just, there are very smart people on the left like Ro Khanna, and on the right like Tom Cotton. There are very smart people across the political spectrum, but the number of people who are simply ignorant of basic law and history is astonishing to me, and it's getting bigger. And I guess I see it mostly on Twitter when there's a great Twitter feed, Bad Legal Takes, and it's truly extraordinary what people say about law, which is completely wrong. It would be like me talking about, you know, being an infantry officer. I would sound stupid immediately because I don't know anything about that, or being a sailor. You just don't know anything about that, but you got to know what you don't know. I'm afraid the ubiquity of the screen, and you'd have to tell me what the mids do now. Do they doom scroll all day on Twitter when they're not doing? Are people addicted to what Kissinger worries about, the image?
I think people are visual animals. And I think the best presentations that you're going to see manage to do both things. I'll give you a practical example. It's Steven Jobs, master presenter, an extraordinary business leader and innovator, a flawed figure. Read Walter Isaacson's biography of him. Steven Jobs is the simple title of it. But think about how Jobs presented. He used images, big ones on a big scale, popping images, big mock-ups. But at the same time, his voiceover was adding to that that understanding of what the image meant. Look, let me read you a quote from page 14 in Leadership by Henry Kissinger. It is not necessary for the leaders of the contemporary great powers to develop a detailed vision of how to resolve dilemmas described here immediately. They must, however, be clear on what has to be avoided and what cannot be tolerated. I think that we are still in an age where we can use the tools of the internet. We can use the visual pop. We can use it in a way that, when it's coupled with an understanding of history and reason, it can be a very powerful tool. And I'll close here by saying, what would people have said who were rough comparators to you and I when the printing press was available? Gosh, now we're going to have millions of these printed texts. It's going to make people get away from the real world and stuff their nose into a piece of paper. Wasn't it better when the monks were creating single illuminated manuscripts and you had to go to a monastery? So the point is, technology changes everything and we have to change with it. And yeah, there are pitfalls and dangers in it. But I think overall, the internet, the ability to move these images, I think can be a tool for good. What we need are the leaders who manage it in moral, sensible, and grounded ways.
Last question. I know that the Commandant of the Marine Corps puts out a reading list. The CNO puts out a reading list. What percentage of officers read the reading list, and are they too long to actually be managed in this internet age?
I think as a percentage, in my experience, 70% of officers have at least a sense of what's on the reading list. They know they need to read professionally. Just like doctors need to read professionally, lawyers need to read professionally, journalists need to understand the ethics and the structure of their profession. The lists themselves in past years, I think, have grown too big. They're huge. They have great numbers. Look at the current CNO reading list. Our friend Admiral Mike Gilday has put out a reading list that I think has 12 books on it.
That's the way to do it. That is the way to do
it.
That's a book a month.
It is.
Right? That's a book a month. That's manageable even for a busy lieutenant commander somewhere, even for a one-star admiral. They can manage a book a month, or they ought to be managing a book a month.
Yeah. Now, I will say that Admiral Gilday cheated slightly because one of the 12 books is called The Sailor's Bookshelf, which is by Admiral Stavridis. Yeah, that's like a slight bit of cheating. There's 50 books in there, but it does provide a detailed.
Oh, by the way, there's not 50 books in there because you call Patrick O'Brien one book. You know, there's actually like 100 books.
It's cheating within cheating. But,
I know. It's anyway, what did they, what did
I
they
think,
say?
I think Admiral Gilday's new reading list, and I don't say this because he was kind enough to put one of my books on it, but it's a very good list of 12 books. I think one a month is a good target. So let's tell General Berger that.
It's so funny. Dune, the novel Dune had plans within plans within plans. Shortcuts within shortcuts within. Admiral James Stavridis, retired. It's always a pleasure, Admiral. Thank you for joining me. You ought to go get the book on risk-taking by the Admiral. It's really superb. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for listening to the Hugh Hewitt Show this morning from Studio North. I am joined by Tevi Troy. Tevi is a presidential historian who is prolific. He's got two great pieces, one in the Washington Examiner from a couple of days ago, Biden Faces a Mutiny, and one in the Wall Street Journal this morning, Biden's Dithering Irks White House Staff. Let's take them in the order you wrote them. Tevi, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Hugh. Thanks. And always great to be on the show.
Well, I love this this Washington Examiner piece because you run through the intra-party challenges to a sitting president. 1912, Teddy Roosevelt against William Howard Taft. 1968, Eugene McCarthy against Lyndon Johnson. Of course, Estes Kefauver was in between there challenging Truman in 52. The very famous 1976 Reagan versus Ford. I was with Ford on that. I was against the tide of history. And then we've got 1980 Jimmy Carter and Teddy Kennedy, which was bloody and long. And then, of course, the 1992 Pat Buchanan insurgency against George H.W. Bush. Of all of those, to what is the greatest parallel to where Biden finds himself today, Tevi Troy?
Yeah, it's a great question. I would say probably 76. I mean, sorry, 80, the Carter versus Kennedy one. You know, inflation, difficult time, economically difficult time around the world. And someone more charismatic comes from the left challenge. We don't know who that is yet. But the really interesting thing is that in all those races you mentioned and that I put in the article, Hugh, the incumbent president never won election again after being challenged. And none of the challengers became president in that cycle.
Because when you bleed out. And if you get wounded in a primary like Pat Buchanan did to W and Ross Perot did to HW, I mean, that will you'll bleed out politically. I think the parallel to me, Tevi, is 1968, because if Biden runs, he's going to run from an incredibly divisive a position and a party that does not like him. And as you say, a staff that thinks he's dithering, Mr. Magoo. You didn't say Mr. Magoo. I did. And therefore, yeah, he may not lose New Hampshire, but someone will do to him what Eugene McCarthy did to LBJ, and then the floodgates will open.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, there is that sense, as in 68, that nobody wants to go first, in part because of the history that I lay out. If you know that running will damage your own party in the upcoming presidential election, you don't want to be tagged as the guy who's disloyal. And so that's why everybody's kind of waiting to see if somebody else will jump in first. So 16.
Yeah, the Washington Post runs a pundit. All the columnists do predictions. And so this week is who's going to be the favorite for the Democratic nominee if Biden doesn't run? And my five are Gavin Newsom, one, Pete Buttigieg, two, Gina Raimondo, three, Josh Shapiro, assuming he wins and he's going to win in Pennsylvania, four, and then Ro Khanna, simply because someone's got to fly the Sanders flag. And they're all not Kamala Harris. I think that's my key point. I don't think she's kind of like Hubert Humphrey without the likelihood of getting the boss's endorsement.
Yeah, look, I don't have any inside information on this, Hugh, but I read a lot on this stuff, and the article suggests that she is quietly reaching out for fundraising help from some of the big donors. She's obviously the vice president, and she's got name recognition, and her political skills are clearly questionable, as you've well laid out on the show. But I wouldn't count her out at this point yet.
You know, it's interesting. I counted her in way too long in 2020, and maybe I'm counting her out too early in 2024. But my gosh, she never fails to disappoint. Tevi Troy, in terms of the White House staff, this is well known about the president. He's not decisive. At what point, how do they signal this? What do they do? You know, you can't really make an old man young.
Yeah, I would actually question this, that whether it's well known that Biden's not decisive. I mean, I think he has been somewhat decisive in the past. I think the issue here, and what I lay out in the Journal column, is that there's this new narrative developing that current Biden, Biden 28.0, is less decisive, and it's a problem. And how does the staff know? How does the staff always let people know? They leak to the media. Right? There was that piece in CNN. There was the piece in Political. that let it out that the staff is irked or that there are bottlenecks and indecision is plaguing the White House, and that some decisions have lingered for over a year. So I think it is an interesting new narrative and something we've got to watch closely.
Tevi, I'm going to be very interested because you're very fair. As you reflect on older people that you have known and what happens to their decision-making skills, and I do not believe the president is incompetent. I do think he's infirm, but infirm in the way any 80-year-old is infirm. Slow, not very eager to change positions, not very flexible or fluid, as Arthur Brooks would say, in the intake of new information, and sometimes bitterly stubborn about things. What percentage of this is Biden aging and not, you know, all that nonsense about dementia? He's got dementia, but he's infirm. What extent of the dithering goes with being old and confronted with new facts?
I think a portion, but I think another portion is being the president, right? Invested with these huge powers and these huge responsibilities. And what I say in the article is that he had a couple of early decisions that didn't work out so well for him. The decision to, hey, let's go big and be LBJ or FDR with a really narrow majority, how things went in Afghanistan. I mean, he was decisive on the Afghanistan thing. I disagreed with how he went, but he's quite decisive there. And I think the power of the office and the import and the long-term historical resonance of these decisions, I think, may be challenging.
Yeah, a kid with a lightsaber or an old man with a lightsaber. It's, you know, you cut through stuff and all of a sudden you've got tens of thousands of Americans, green card holders and SIV applicants stuck in Afghanistan with a ruthless Taliban. And we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary of that. Tevi, you remember the 1 year anniversary of Katrina and how W was hauled over the coals. Are we going to get a 1 year anniversary on Afghanistan with the same kind of look back?
I doubt it. I mean, I think there'll be some of it, but people forget. But the press had a special glee in going after W, for whom, as you know, I worked in the White House. And I think they were just so eager to write those 1 year after pieces.
Oh, I could not agree more. I'm on a jihad against the use of 100% because it's spread like kudzu throughout the culture. But I could not agree more, Tevi, that the Katrina anniversary was the part of the campaign against W by legacy media. And the parallel for catastrophic decision-making early on is the decision to close Bagram followed by the consequences. So the decision not to evacuate followed by the consequences. Actually, by W, it was the decision to defer to the governor and the mayor, wasn't it?
Yeah, but also, it took a while before he left on the vacation and he flew over, which was a really bad photo op. I mean, you know, there were mistakes. And you know, again, I was sorry to recount them because I was on the White House staff at the time. But I've written about some of the mistakes he made in that circumstance that did not work out so well.
Okay, so the next piece I hope you attempt is the worst presidential year ever. I always tell people they're going to have a worse year in their adult life than a best year. And you get through the worst so that eventually you enjoy the best and maybe a few great ones with grandchildren. But the worst year for W with 05, that begins with Terry Schiavo. It goes with the attempt to reform Social Security that is bottled up by Harry Reid. It is followed by Harriet Myers and Katrina, and it's the nightmare in Afghanistan and Iraq grows worse. It's the worst year. Has Biden had his worst year?
It's quite possible because this year was pretty awful. And you talk about Afghanistan and maybe the legacy media won't focus on the 1 year anniversary, but Afghanistan clearly took a hit. You know, Biden's approval ratings weren't that bad before Afghanistan. It was really
never recovered
down. And then obviously inflation exploded and energy prices and the Ukraine invasion. And so suddenly people are saying, hey, maybe this Biden pick wasn't such a great one. So yeah, it's been a pretty bad year, but you know, you can look at the Carter administration as a succession of bad years. It's not like there was a great year in there. And it seems in some ways with Carter, things were getting worse. And in fact, there were a lot of bad things going on in Carter before the Iran hostage situation emerged. And then obviously the debacle where they tried the failed rescue. So things just sometimes when things are bad, they just keep cascading and getting worse.
The difference with Carter is that he was a young man and he adapted to the invasion of the Afghanistan by the Soviet Union and he armed the Mujahideen and he built defense spending up. Is there any pivot that Joe can make that would be as dramatic as when the president said he had been paralyzed by an inordinate fear of communism?
Yeah, I think it is possible. I mean, he sold himself as this moderate. You know, as you and I know, he's not an actual moderate, but kind of a moderate in that he's between the left wing and the moderate ring of the Democratic Party, not in the moderate sense in the whole country. But I think he could pivot after an election loss. And I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal last month about the ways presidents have pivoted and how to plan for that in advance. So I think it's possible. I just don't think the way he's been kowtowing to the left wing of the party makes it likely.
It's a fascinating couple of pieces, Tevye. Well done on both of them. I just tweeted them both out. You should be following Tevye Troy on Twitter and reading everything he does, because a historian is someone to contend with. Thank you, Tevye. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Don't go anywhere, America. I've got another 75 minutes on the air, then I'm making my tracks to Atlanta, Hotlanta, as we say. I'll be at the Varsity on one of these days, Thursday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And otherwise, at the American Legislative Exchange Council, you should go over to alec.org right now, and you'll see why I'm going. It's a geek's paradise. State legislators talking about unfunded pension liabilities. It's to me, it's a trade show of ideas, and I love that. And I love talking to people who are in the front lines of state legislatures, especially on school choice and the backpack bills. American Legislative Exchange Council, or alec.org, is where you go. Come right back. I'll be back with more news on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. The big political news of the morning is Trafalgar and Emerson, two good polling groups. Trafalgar, better than Emerson, have both put in Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt in a commanding lead over Eric Greitens, and Vicky Hartzler in second place between both of them. But the key is the collapse of Eric Greitens. And Josh Krauschauer joins me, senior political reporter at Axios. Josh, to what do you attribute the collapse of Greitens?
Really simple, Hugh. There's a super PAC that just started up, spending a good amount of money telling Missouri voters about Eric Greitens' record of domestic abuse and ethical problems. Just putting that information out there, we all assume that everyone in Missouri knows every detail about the Greitens' record. It wasn't out there until these ads went up on the air, and the polling that you're talking about, Hugh, has coincided with that ad blitz that a lot of mainstream Republicans are doing in the state of Missouri.
Now, who's behind the super PAC?
Well, there's one of the biggest funders. The name escapes me right now, but one of the big mainstream Republican donors in Missouri. You may know Johnny DiStefano, who worked in the Trump White House.
Excellent, smart guy.
He doesn't take sides. He doesn't have a side in the Schmidt versus Hartzler primary. But he's helped organize that super PAC, because he's seen as a straight shooter who just wants the Republican Party to have some mainstream or non-extreme voices in the Senate.
Johnny was in the Trump White House for a while, and a very, very straight shooter. Like me, he's a Republican, and he wants a majority back in the United States Senate led by Mitch McConnell. And he knows that Greitens would lose the general, right? I mean, that's just not even there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, there's a good chance that could happen, but even worse, I think, for Republicans to have someone who is a domestic, alleged domestic abuser, who has the record that Greitens has, left the governorship in disgrace. That would tar other Republicans as well. It would be a big black eye for the Republican Party.
And to be specific, domestic abuse against his wife, allegations of rape against a girlfriend who he cheated on his wife while he was in office. Allegations of exploiting his campaign fund for personal use. He would have been impeached, but he resigned before that happened. He was, and I want to put this out there, he was unjustly pursued on different counts by the St. Louis district attorney, which has provided him smoke with which to cover up his real failings. But I think the smoke is being blown away now, Josh.
Well, and there's a larger issue here, I think, that shows that it takes money, it takes outside intervention to get good Republican candidates through these nominations. And when the super PAC started spending money reminding folks about Greitens' record, the numbers moved dramatically. In Maryland, we just saw a really competitive primary in Maryland versus an unelectable Republican and a mainstream Republican. No one's decided to help the mainstream Republican with TV ads. In fact, the Democrats spent money on behalf of the extreme Republican who's now the nominee. And you're seeing in Senate races and governor's races, essentially, the Republicans taking a hands-off approach in these primaries. Even it took them a long time, even in Missouri with Eric Greitens, it took them the final couple of weeks of that race. And that, the other big storyline of 2022, especially in the Senate races, is that you have some Republicans that may not be ready for prime time, even with a very, very good political environment.
Generally, I don't do primaries. I tried to get McCormick over the line, didn't work. I stayed out of Ohio, my home state. JD won. I looked down at Arizona. I'm not endorsing between Blake Masters and Mark Brnovich. They're both good guys. They'll both be good senators. I think they'll both beat Kelly. It looks to me like Karen Robson is catching and passing Kerry Lake because the fake Lake stuff has stuck, but I haven't endorsed in that. Do you have any takes on that one?
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be the bellwether. That is a toss-up. The Robson has the support of Penn, support of Governor Ducey. She's also spending a whole lot more money. I mean, Kerry Lake's out of money. And that's an underexplored dynamic. She's not spent. She got Trump in for the rally, which is a lot of her free media, but not a lot of ads on TV. Robson is spending millions and millions of dollars on TV, and she's been able to kind of close the gap, maybe even take the lead. But that is going to be the biggest bellwether of whether, you know, that is a classic Trump versus Pence and Ducey, and it's in a state that's so important for the general election.
What about on the Senate side? Again, most people have gone hands off on the Senate race.
Yeah, well, look, Ducey has not taken sides. Governor Ducey hasn't taken sides in the Senate race. I think largely because he's not enamored with any of the candidates there. I've been hearing Masters, because of the Trump endorsement, holds a pretty sizable edge at this point. But he's also the Republican that comes up the most when they worry that he could lose what should be a very winnable race against Senator Mark Kelly. He says these things, whether it's privatizing Social Security or saying the Unabomber was an underrated political thinker. He likes to go off the cuff. He doesn't believe in kind of running the type of campaign that most candidates do. And there's some polling out in Arizona that just suggests that if Masters is the nominee, the Republicans could have a tough time winning that seat.
You know, I'm gonna go against the grain there with either of them, simply because I believe the environment is so bad for Democrats in Arizona, so bad that you can make a lot of first-timer mistakes. And I've seen Blake Masters have made some. Berno wouldn't make those. Berno would be a safe choice to beat Mark Kelly. Last question for you. Liz Cheney mentioned a presidential run. What is the ceiling for a Liz Cheney presidential run in any open primary?
Well, look, I the way I split the Republican vote, 40% MAGA, 40% wanting to look forward, looking for a more future-oriented candidate, 20% anti-Trump. It's hard to win with 20% without getting any of that other 80% of the Republican electorate.
Yep. I think that's fair. As always, Josh Kroshauer. Follow Josh at Josh Kroshauer. 20% would be generous. I hope she doesn't do that. I think that would be embarrassing. Josh Kroshauer, thank you. I'll be right back, America, tomorrow from Atlanta and the American Legislative Exchange Council gathering. Join us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.